Well, welcome to the third week of our message series that we're calling Altitude Adjustment. It's about improving our attitude by getting a better perspective on things. The better our attitude becomes, the more productively we can handle life's problems. And so, in this series, we're looking at six altitude adjustments that we can make by climbing a little higher and seeing things the way God sees them. Now, 2 weeks ago when we started this series, we looked at the first of these adjustments, and we said that many of us have an attitude of shame. We carry around with us deep-seated feelings of shame. And we said that the only way to overcome that is to stop focusing on our own inadequacies and start focusing on Christ and His grace. Then last week, we looked at another adjustment that some of us could make by becoming more trustworthy with the things of God. You know, as difficult as it may be to think about, all of us one day will have to render an account for our lives. We will have to explain why we did the things that we did. And that can be a little daunting, but when you're willing to be honest with yourself now and ask yourself whether there are some areas in your life in which you could become more trustworthy, then you will never have to fear the reaper. So those are two altitude adjustments, ways of changing our attitude. And today we're going to look at a third one that Jesus speaks about in the gospel. He tells a very disturbing parable about it. And the story, as we heard, begins like this. There was a rich man who dressed in purple garments. Now I want to stop right there because purple in those days was something that was worn only by royalty or by people who were uber rich, because purple dye cost a tremendous amount of money. So we know that this man was either royalty or near royalty. In addition, he dined sumptuously each day, not just on special celebrations, but every single day. And lying at his door was a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who would gladly have eaten the scraps from the man's table. Now, the problem at first, when you read these opening lines, it seems that the problem is the inequality between the two men, right? It doesn't seem fair that the rich man gets to wear the finest clothes and eat the best food, while Lazarus goes hungry and is so accursed that dogs would come and lick his sores. And I don't know if you notice this, but even in death, the rich man initially is treated better. He receives the dignity of a proper burial, while there is no mention of one for Lazarus. But then things change after both men die. The rich man goes off to a place of punishment and torment, while Lazarus goes to a place of comfort and reward. And the rest of the parable is about how the rich man tries to get out of this predicament. He is so surprised, he's genuinely surprised by the reversal of fortunes, that he also tries to prevent his family members from suffering the same fate. So what exactly did the rich man do wrong? Was it merely the fact that he was rich and Lazarus was poor? If that's the case, then I have to say we're all in trouble in this country. Or was there more to it? Let's go back to the beginning of the story and take a closer look. Notice that Lazarus was not a poor man somewhere in town. You know, he wasn't someone that the rich man encountered at the Cove Shopping Center when he was doing his weekly grocery shopping. He didn't encounter him in downtown Tiburon on a corner somewhere or in front of a synagogue or a church. No, Lazarus was literally lying at his door, and he did nothing. He didn't even give him the scraps that fell from his table. He must have passed by Lazarus 100 times, 1,000 times, maybe. But it seems that he didn't do the slightest thing to help. You know, the name Lazarus in Hebrew means God has helped. But ironically, the rich man was of no help to Lazarus. The rich man, otherwise known as Dives, that's his name in the Christian tradition, Dives, it just means rich man, he had an attitude of indifference. He had become complacent about an unjust situation right in front of him. And because he didn't lift a finger to help the man suffering right next to him, a great chasm now separates the two men for all eternity. And to compound the problem, did you catch this? The rich man treated Lazarus like a lowly servant in the afterlife. When he asked Abraham, send Lazarus, like he's a servant, right? Send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am suffering torment in these flames. And then again, remember later, he asked Abraham to send Lazarus with a message to his brothers to warn them that they had better change their ways. You see, not only did Dives do nothing to help Lazarus in this life, he expected him to serve him in the next. He had an attitude of privileged complacency, and that was the problem. Complacency. You know, it's a kind of a feeling that, you know, we've arrived at something. It's a kind of a feeling of being satisfied with yourself or a kind of false confidence that keeps you from trying harder. When you've reached a certain place in your career or your marriage or your personal growth, you know, it's very tempting. Complacency is a strong temptation to take what you have achieved for granted and to stop trying. You know, at the beginning of every new job or a new sport that you might be playing or a new course that you might be taking in school or a new relationship, right? It can be challenging, right? Because it's so new and you're not familiar with it. And so you have to focus. You have to focus. I remember my first Mass. It was a disaster. I made so many mistakes, and the worst one was that my mom was there, and see, I was supposed to present her with a special cloth that's called a maniturgium. You see, when a priest is ordained, his hands are anointed by the bishop on the palm of his hands with special oil called chrism, and then he receives a special cloth that he puts between the palms of his hands in order to soak up the excess oil. And the tradition that grew up around that is that the priest presents this cloth, this maniturgium, to his mother at his first Mass. And she keeps it until her death. And then it's buried with her as evidence that, you know, she produced a priest for the kingdom of God. It's a sweet tradition. Only I left the damn thing in the car. I left it in the trunk of my car. And I didn't remember it until it was time to present her with it in the middle of Mass. I'm such an idiot. Well, here's a picture of a good priest presenting his mom with the maniturgium. Obviously, he didn't forget it in his car. Anyway, I'd like to think that I've gotten a little better at celebrating Mass since then. But now, you know what I have to guard against? Is complacency. It's easy to go on autopilot with anything that becomes routine, including Mass. And that can lead to problems. Complacency is a problem in every aspect of life. We can become complacent in our careers by not focusing on producing excellent work anymore. We can become complacent in our relationships by taking people for granted, our spouses or our parents. We can become complacent in our faith by just going through the motions Sunday after Sunday and not really focusing on spiritual growth. And it's also really easy to become complacent about the injustices that we see in the world all around us. And when we fail to act, it's for many reasons, right? We're distracted, or we figure it's somebody else's problem to fix. Doesn't the government have a program on that? We're afraid that we won't have enough time or money for ourselves if we try to do something about it. Or we tell ourselves that we'll get to it. We're going to do something about this injustice one day when things settle down, but they never do. Complacency is insidious, and it creeps into everything we do. But when it comes to the poor, God will not stand for it. That's the reason the rich man in the parable found himself where he did. It's why the prophet Amos, in the first reading, warned those who were well off in Jerusalem that they would be the first to go into exile. What'd they do wrong? They were not made ill by the collapse of Joseph. The same mistake as the rich man. They were complacent and unconcerned with the injustices visited upon the poor and the most vulnerable in their community. You and I, we have to fight against that same kind of complacency. You know, one of our core values, we have several core values, we have four of them that our leadership team and parish council decided on a few years ago. And one of those core values is that every person, everyone matters. And that means everyone, including the poor, the dirty, the lowly, the marginalized, the hard to look at, the ones we turn our heads away from, the people we avoid meeting their eyes. And we want to help you and me, because I struggle with it too, we want to help all of us to fight the temptation toward apathy and complacency. We have several outreach ministries, or what we call missions, that offer support and help to those most in need. Please take a look at this quick video.
Good morning. My name is Bill Teege. I've been a parishioner here for over 30 years, and I would like to speak to you today a little bit about some of the ministries we have at St. Hilary. We are asked to combine with our faith good works for others. And some of the opportunities you might have here are working within St. Hilary, such as faith formation and choir or lectors or those types of programs, or greeters at the front of the church. We also want to provide you with programs outside where you can help others, such as St. Vincent de Paul, who has a very active program here at St. Hilary and helping those who are in need, possibly for food or lodging or many other programs. Other activity outside are lunches for the homeless that are done here normally on a weekly basis. And there is a prison ministry that has not been active for since the pandemic, but I think this will also bring an opportunity. For each of you, you have to make your own decision as to what is important to you. And if you visit our website at sthillary.org, you will find over 25 ministries that might give you the opportunity you're looking for your good works. And we invite you to come and join us at St. Hilary as we develop our outreach programs for our parish community. Thank you.
So we are doing very good work with these outreach ministries that we currently have, but I believe we can do more. I believe we have to do more. I want to introduce you to an idea called a compassionate cause. I first learned about this idea in a book written by Tim Lucas, the pastor of one of the fastest growing churches in America. His book is called Liquid Church, and you'll find out why in just a second. In the book, he describes what happened when compassion went viral in his local congregation. After learning about the horrible plight of impoverished children in other countries drinking contaminated water, he challenged his people to donate enough money to dig one well that would provide clean water for an entire village. It would cost about $5,000. The next day, a man came into the church office and plunked down a check for $5,000. Now, he was not a rich man. He said it was supposed to be the down payment on a new Harley Davidson motorcycle, and he'd been saving for it for years. But he said he couldn't, in good conscience, go through with it. The next week, a couple gave up their plans to remodel their basement for a home theater, and they donated $2,500. Another man sold his baseball memorabilia. Week after week, the money poured in to help these poor children. Today, that church has funded and drilled over 280 wells in 9 nations. Each one of those will provide clean, fresh water for 450 people in a village over a 20-year period. Every 90 seconds, a child dies from a water-related disease. Can you imagine the number of lives saved by that one church's generosity? They were able to do it because they focused on one single compassionate cause. Focusing on a single cause rather than a long list of options is an extremely powerful way of helping the poor. There are so many causes that we could care about. But a focused cause would allow us to make a tremendous impact together. I think you know that we all live in a kind of bubble here in Southern Marin. I don't need to tell you that. And it makes it easy to grow complacent and to forget about the plight of the poor, whether they live thousands of miles away or right next door. And so over the next few years, it is my hope that you and I will dream together, that we'll discern a way forward, that maybe, if you all like this idea, that maybe we could agree on a single compassionate cause and commit ourselves to it, to really make an impact. You know, the Japanese rail system is among the safest in the world, and a big part of that is because they developed a method to reduce workplace accidents resulting from complacency. They call it pointing and calling. All the workers do it. For example, when the engineer in the train is checking his speed, he doesn't just look at the speedometer and then think about it in his mind. No, he points to it, and they all wear white gloves. He points to the speedometer and says out loud, "Speed check. 80. There's no one around him. He's just doing it because that's what he's supposed to do. Or the conductor, before the train leaves the station, doesn't just look at the platform to make sure that there's no hazards. He or she sweeps his or her hand along the platform like that, and then, and only then, calls out all clear. You see, somehow the physical movement of pointing and calling out sort of raises the awareness of the possible dangers and reduces errors that happen because of complacency. Why am I telling you this? Because I keep thinking, what if together, when we saw an injustice, when we see an injustice in this world, what if we could move beyond complacency and apathy and fear and distraction and procrastination and burnout and loss of passion? What if we, like the Japanese railway workers, could point out that injustice and say out loud to everyone, we're going to fix that together?